You're listening to the Simply Lived In podcast, episode number 14. Today, I am so excited to share with you my conversation with Jessie Johnson. She is an incredible lady who saw a disconnect between the research happening in creating sustainable food systems and the education that consumers had when it came to making sustainable food choices. So like a true activist, Jessie decided to do something about it. In this episode, she talks all about how as consumers, we can educate ourselves through resources that actually make these issues easy to understand. We dig into how to get educated, avoid overwhelm, and eat locally.
You're listening to the Simply Lived In podcast, where we understand that needing less helps us to be so much more. Entrepreneur and sustainability advocate, Meg Ross, will help you to break down how to create more space in your life. Get ready to hear from strong women who are redefining what living well looks like. If you've dreamed of being present, cutting the clutter, and putting an end to the busyness, this is the place to be. Here's your host, designer, motivator, and simplicity enthusiast, Meg Ross.
Hi, Simply listeners. Today we are on with Jessie. Jessie is a podcaster, chef, a food educator. She is absolutely hilarious and she shares recipes and real life, but she also sheds light on the important work of creating sustainable food systems. She is full of knowledge about our food and she shares it on her blog, Life as a Strawberry, and her podcast, At the Table. Wow, Jessie, you have so much going on and I just want to thank you so much for being here with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Jessie and how Life as a Strawberry was started?
So my academic background is all in food systems. So after undergrad, I was kind of in between my undergraduate work and my graduate school experience. And I was living in the town I went to college in. I was working for a couple nonprofits and doing some major event planning. And I wanted to keep my feet in the food world. So as an undergrad, I had done work with community food programs, and I had worked with hunger relief organizations and looked at the way that our childhood food ways impact our adult eating habits. And so I wanted to kind of, in my head, I was thinking I would like prove to graduate schools that I was still keeping up with all the research. So I started a food blog, which is Life as a Strawberry, which has since like weirdly become my full-time job. But I, at the time, was just sharing a couple of recipes. I was practicing using this camera that I had basically never touched. And then when I went to grad school, I kept the blog going just kind of as a side project. And by the time I finished grad school, it was earning me almost as much as I would have made if I'd gone into a nonprofit job like I was thinking about. So I decided to take it full time. And then all of the other stuff that you mentioned has kind of snowballed from there. So it's been a really crazy experience and a lot of fun. But I get to talk about food every day, which is awesome.
That is so awesome. What made you decide to use your blog as a platform to talk about the real issues going on in the food system when you could have just, you know, done the research for yourself, but you decided to share it with other people?
Sure. I think it was two things mostly. First, I noticed a real disconnect when I started my food blog between the people. And at that time, that was like 2012. So it wasn't in its infancy necessarily, but it was definitely like not as saturated as it is today. So there were a couple like people that I connected with that also had blogs and, you know, there was a kind of a smaller group of us and that was about it. But we were talking every single day about food and nobody was talking about where it came from. And I think that was probably partially because most of the food bloggers that I knew at that time had started it not out of an academic purpose. They wanted to share recipes with their family or they wanted like a cool side project. And so I think I was coming at it with a very different lens. So I thought that it was necessary for us as a group, because we were talking about food every day, to also be talking about where it came from. So that was one part of it. And the other side of it was that as somebody who had been in academia and who had done a lot of research and worked on a lot of research projects, I saw a really terrible disconnect between academia and people working in boots on the ground organizations. So as researchers, we are not, as a group, very good at distilling our research and making it accessible to people who are doing the work. So a lot of times you'll see a really interesting study get published and then it goes out in a journal and then it sits behind a paywall and it never actually reaches the people running the organizations who would benefit from that information. So that was kind of the double-edged coin, I guess, double-edged sword that I was thinking of when I was like, okay, well, here's an opportunity, one, to pull in influencers who are reaching a lot of people to talk about these issues, and two, to take some of that kind of higher level, super academic focused information and distill it in a way that makes it more accessible to people.
Oh my gosh, that is so great. And you do a great job of that on your blog. I noticed you're welcome. When I was reading through, you absolutely break things down. You make it fun to read. I saw similar disconnects with the apparel and fashion industry. And so I completely resonate with your mission to just really break it down for people on how to really implement some things in your own lifestyle, and especially where you're digging into the systems behind it. I think that is such great work.
Oh, thanks.
So how is our current food system unsustainable for people who aren't very familiar?
I think it maybe makes sense to start with what is sustainable. You ask people like, oh, this, it's such a buzzword now. And people are like, oh, this is sustainable and this is unsustainable. And I think for us, for me in particular, when I talk about sustainability, I'm talking about taking what we need from the land and the sea without denying future generations the ability to do so also. So when we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about making sure that we're not taking all of one resource, that we're not taking all of one species, that we're not totally exhausting any piece of the supply chain. And so I think I always like to start with just kind of an overview of what we consider to be sustainable, because our food system is unsustainable in a lot of ways. And I think it might even be more accurate to just say wasteful in a lot of ways. I work a lot specifically, as an example, with fishermen, particularly with wild salmon in Alaska. So for those who don't know, Alaska has one of the last and arguably the best managed wild salmon runs left in the world. Salmon across the world have been overfished, which means we've taken more out of the ocean than they can put back through natural reproduction. And if anybody's interested in learning more about that, I won't go too far into it, but there's a great documentary called The Breach that I highly, highly recommend. So we look at salmon from a sustainability lens of we have to make sure that we are not taking so many out of the ocean that they're not going to come back again next year. And in Alaska in particular, that requires a lot of collaboration between the state, between the fishermen, between all of the stakeholders throughout that system. Because in a lot of other fisheries, you see overfishing just decimate populations of wild fish. And I totally lost my train of thought there because I got all excited about salmon. But for seafood in particular, which is one of the areas that I tend to work in the most, overfishing is a huge, huge symptom of a wasteful system and an unsustainable system. You also see things like soil degradation, in farms and agriculture across the country. There are a lot of little things that add up to a very wasteful system. And I think it's when you talk about unsustainable practices, you could go on for a really long time. It's a very long list. But I think that also makes me a little bit hopeful because there are so many small different pieces that we could fix in different ways. So it's not like one massive just completely overwhelming problem. We can focus on different pieces of the food system and make small changes in different areas. And together that adds up to a really big difference.
I agree completely. Yeah. And like you said, there's so many unsustainable aspects to the food system. And I really appreciate you clarifying kind of what sustainability means in your terms from the food standpoint, because I agree that it is such a buzzword. And I see that with clothing too. You know, companies will claim to be sustainable and it's kind of just this overarching word that they use that has kind of become more of a marketing thing. And it's really hard for consumers then to make educated choices when, you know, words are kind of just being thrown around.
Absolutely.
So what is the Sustainable Seafood Blog Project, which is back to the salmon, I believe, that you were just talking about, but it's a way that you decided to make a difference?
So when I first, this was probably a year into running Life as a Strawberry, before I went to grad school, I was thinking, like I said, about how to engage other people with food blogs, other influencers in a conversation about sustainability. I had gone to undergrad with some people who were involved in starting a company called Sitka Salmon Shares, which served as a connection between wild Alaskan salmon and Midwest consumers. So initially, I was just talking to a friend who had been a part of building that company about, you know, I think people are reading my blog. Maybe I could like write a thing and people would buy a piece of fish from you. And so she and I were talking about, you know, how I would help them and maybe I would do a recipe or something. And then I had the idea to pull in all of these other bloggers kind of along those lines of, we're trying to pull in other people and we're trying to really engage our readers in a conversation about sustainability. So I emailed probably every single food blogger that I knew at that point, and I asked if they would be interested in joining this campaign with me. And a handful said yes. And so on a day in, I want to say 2013, we all posted a seafood recipe on our websites on the same day. And then my only criteria was that you had to make a recipe and you had to use that recipe as an opportunity to talk to your readers about sustainable seafood. So we gave them some resources. I sent them information on my friend's company. I sent them information on everything that I knew at the time about seafood and sustainable fisheries, and kind of let them pick their own path through all of that information, which was so interesting because every single person. And now we've initiated, I think, 3 partner classes. So we work with about 20 food bloggers and a handful of organizations and nonprofits and businesses. And every person who has ever done what we call now our inaugural post has tackled a different issue of sustainability in the seafood supply chain. So, you know, even with something as specific as seafood sustainability, there are so many moving pieces, which was really exciting, one, to see just the wealth of information that was being shared, but also that, you know, we can all find kind of our own way to make a difference, especially when it comes to sustainable food. And what's right for one person wasn't right for the other person, and that's totally fine. So that was really exciting. Today, we still work with bloggers, and we run an annual event called Plenty Retreat in collaboration with Life as a Strawberry and the podcast. And we just wrapped an event in New Orleans where we got about 30 people together and just talked about business and sustainable food and how to make a difference. So it was really great.
I love that. I love that you just found your specific niche and kind of dug into that. And like you said, it's so specific, but I think that helps people gravitate towards it, you know, because you can say things like the salmon have been, it's salmon you said, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
have been overfished. Like that is kind of unbelievable that that can even happen, that humans would even do that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so along with the unsustainable issues that go on, there's also a lot of hunger that coincides with that, kind of in the way our food systems work. People don't have equal access to food. And you talk a lot about that on your blog as well. So can you tell us what you think the most important thing people need to know about hunger in America is, or just kind of the basics that it exists for people that might not be very in tune to the fact that some people, you know, are kind of in food deserts, which we can touch on too.
Yeah. So hunger, again, is like one of those things that has so many moving pieces. I'm particularly passionate about hunger issues. That's where my background is. I grew up, my mom, when I was 15, started a community food program. So I grew up in that kitchen. I did all of my undergrad work on hunger and food advocacy, and I did all of my graduate work on the stigma of hunger in America. So this is like definitely my my big like soapbox issue. But I think the most important thing to know is that poverty, particularly hunger in America, is not, it looks a lot different than people think it does. So I think when we think of poverty or we think of hunger, we think of somebody like, you know, on a street corner, like a lot of times we think of somebody who's homeless or somebody who is lazy, or there are all of these tropes associated with hunger, and they're not accurate at all. Hungry people could look like the neighbor next to you in a big house who has fallen on hard times. Hunger can look like a kid at school who is acting out because he doesn't get breakfast at home. There is no one portrait of a hungry person. And I think that's really important to remember, especially because we're in a farm bill year this year, which means that the SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is being retooled a little bit. You have probably definitely seen stuff about it in the news. And I think it's really important, especially in a year where hunger is so at the forefront of politics, to remember that there are a lot of different faces of hunger. And we can't just kind of put everybody into a one size fits all bucket. So I think that's like the most important thing for me, is that we all, and myself included at times, like, need to reserve kind of the stereotyping of poverty, particularly when it comes to hunger, because all it does is it makes everybody meaner to each other. And it encourages us to stigmatize people who have just fallen on hard times, and it makes it harder for these services to do their job. So kind of just looking at these issues with an open mind and remembering that there's a lot of stuff that we don't see on the surface when we talk about hunger. And then also, like, we're all one really bad day away from being in the same situation, you know? If I like lost my job tomorrow and got kicked out of our apartment, like, I would not just be able to bounce right back up. So it's understanding that, like, everybody's circumstance is different, and just kind of generally having compassion is, I think, the most important thing that we can remember when it comes to hunger, for sure.
I agree completely. And just a willingness to learn and be open-minded. Like you said, I read something you had written about, because SNAP, if I'm remembering your post right, is kind of also known, or used to be known, as like food stamps.
Right. Yeah.
And people kind of have a lot of preconceived notions and judgments, like you mentioned, about who should qualify for food stamps or what they are, what they do. And you did a survey and educated some, or you did a survey with like 60 people, I think you said, and this was, you better just explain it, but basically what you found is that people really weren't that educated and kind of were making judgments about things that they had the facts a little wrong.
Yeah, you totally nailed it. That was awesome. So that was my graduate thesis at Cornell. And we looked at the intersection of stigma and SNAP. So one of my biggest, like, researcher pet peeves is when I see people in the news be like, food stamp recipients, blah, 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 because the food stamp program was replaced. The federal food stamp program was replaced by SNAP in 2008. Like, people will be like, oh, I saw people using their national food stamp card to buy something at the store. And I'm like, well, you didn't, because it hasn't existed for 10 years. So that's like my big thing. And particularly with the media, I try to be really good about, like, using the correct terminology. Because I think one, and in the research that I did in grad school, that was what we found too, is like, the terms matter, like the words we use and the language we use matters. And so that's part of why I'm really careful to say SNAP as opposed to food stamps, because, you know, I think you can even just hear it when you say it, like, one of those has a very different connotation. And we did look at, so we sent out a survey, and we were kind of piloting it to see if it was even, if it was something worth pursuing. And the results were really interesting. So we surveyed 60 some people, I think that was right. And we asked them questions. Like, so we did a variety of questions, like a true false section. We asked them to rate how much they agreed or disagreed with statements about people who received SNAP benefits. And we found a pretty significant correlation between having correct information about the SNAP program and having a better opinion of people who utilized the benefits. So, in, like, the short version is, if you know about the program, if, like, you know the rules and you know how it works, then you're less likely to think the people on it are, like, lazy or, you know, bad people or something. So that tells us that having accurate information is really important to stigma, to combating stigma. And that tells us that we need to do a better job as researchers, but also as educators and as people doing boots on the ground work, of communicating what these programs actually do. There is a ton of research that says that SNAP works. Like, it's something, I forget the most recent statistic, but it's something like for every dollar that we spend on SNAP, we generate $1.70 in economic activity, which is a good thing. That gives people the opportunity to put more money into our economy, which strengthens our economy. It helps people lift themselves out of poverty. I could tell you so many stories about people who SNAP or some other kind of government assistance was the bridge for them between a really terrible situation and just totally getting their life back on track and like doing amazing things for the world. So, yeah, the research was really interesting. And I think after grad school, like when I took the blog full time, it was weird because my focus kind of shifted from, okay, the research is the most important thing that I'm doing as I was finishing my master's. And then, oh, wait, now I have to like talk about food, but in a very different way, so that we could, you know, pay rent and get health insurance and all these things that come with being a real grown-up. But now that the blog has gotten a little bit more established and we're bringing on staff to handle more of the day-to-day, I get to really refocus on disseminating that kind of sustainable food information, which means that I get to dig back into the research and I get to dig back into stuff like I was working on in grad school, which has been really exciting.
I love that. And I so value you as an educator, because all these things that you are saying, I know that I had never dug into before. And I value sustainable food systems, obviously. And I consider myself someone who tries to eat well. And yet I'm myself super undereducated on some of these issues, just because, you know, I put the blinders on sometimes and focus on what I have to do. And there's a lot of noise out there, you know. So yeah, you bringing attainable, you know, digestible information to the table is so valuable.
Oh, that makes me so happy. I mean, yeah. Like, yeah, it's hard enough to like feed yourself when you have money, you know, like, there's so many complicated moving pieces to food.
Oh my gosh. I completely.
It's so easy to just like get totally lost in a black hole of groceries.
It is. And another way that you educate people is through your podcast. So can you tell us a little bit about your podcast and what your mission is to do through that?
Yeah. So we just launched the podcast in November. It's called At the Table. And on Life as a Strawberry, since like 2015, it was right after I finished grad school, I had started doing a photojournalism series also called At the Table, where I basically cajoled farmers and fishermen and winemakers into letting me follow them around with my camera for a day, which was really fun. So we did a few posts in that series. But one, that was really hard because I had to get places. So it took a ton of time. And then we had to do all the images and it involved a lot of travel. And then I felt like I was really, I was trying to be a storyteller, but I felt like I was helming their story and I didn't really love that. So I felt like the podcast was a really natural extension of that series because one, we could produce more of them because there was lower cost associated with it. And it was easier to get people to give you, you know, an hour of their time than a full day of their time, which is what we were doing with the photo series. And then I really wanted people to hear their voices. You know, it's one thing to hear me like blab on about, you know, sustainable food and fish. And it's a totally different thing to hear a fisherman tell you, like, here's what I do on my boat. So, I was really excited about giving people the chance to tell their stories, and it's been really fun. As I'm sure you know, like people working behind the scenes and working, like a lot of our food system is kind of an invisible process, right? Like how often are any of us on a farm or on a fishing boat or kind of in the nitty gritty of our food production? And so a lot of this work is invisible and a lot of the people doing that work don't really get recognized the same way that like celebrity chefs do or Food Network stars do or, you know, more like traditional celebrity type people. So it's been really exciting to have, you know, farmers on who don't get asked to do interviews a lot, but whose work is still valuable. And to be able to show not only our guests, who I think sometimes work, sometimes their work is very lonely. And being on a podcast is often like just a really great encouragement for people who are doing really hard, really thankless work. So that's been a real privilege to be able to show people like, this matters, keep going, you're doing awesome things. But also to share these stories with people who might have like a kind of interest in sustainable food. But again, like we've talked about, it's a huge huge industry and you don't really know where to start. So I think this has been really nice to kind of bring a person, like somebody's face to an issue. And it's a lot less like, you know, me talking at you and a lot more like you sitting down for coffee with a friend who, oh, hey, also happens to be a really important farmer. So I've really loved getting to hear these stories and getting to talk to these people, but also getting to, you know, sit down in a really, again, like accessible, comfortable, really casual setting and just be like, you know, tell me about the work that you do. It's been really like an honor to get to share their stories with people because our guests are doing some really incredible things.
I love that. Yes. Such important work completely. How do you, have any suggestions on how we can change our grocery shopping habits to positively contribute to a more sustainable food system?
There are a bunch of things that you can do. I think the most important thing is to be okay taking baby steps. And we talk about this. So on all of our, every At the Table episode, we end with an action item, which has been really cool because they all say different things. And so we've really been focusing on baby steps, right? So I think number one, understand that it's not an all or nothing thing. You don't, if you decide today that you want to be a more sustainable eater or a more environmentally conscious eater, that doesn't mean that you have to like completely overhaul everything that you do. So I love telling people to start with baby steps. And that can be as simple as going to a farmer's market if you haven't been to the one in your neighborhood, or Googling a UPIC farm near you and going and like just putting your hands in the dirt and seeing the food where it grows, or go to the grocery store and see if they have a section from local farmers. Or even just something as simple as like listening to a podcast like this, like just set aside 10 minutes a day to learn something new about food. I think just there are so many different good places to start. And so it's hard to be like, this is like the right first step. And I think it's different for everybody. So if you eat a lot of seafood and a lot of salmon, buy wild Alaskan salmon next time you go to the store. If you eat a lot of beef, maybe buy grass-fed or find a local farmer, a local cattle farmer where you can buy, you know, beef. Like you can buy like a quarter cow or a half cow and get beef for the year all from the same source. So there are a lot of really great little things. And I will try to cut it off there because I don't want to just like ramble about it forever. But yeah, it's definitely baby steps. Definitely baby steps.
Yes, that's great. Oh my gosh, you could ramble all day. But I agree. Like it was good to cut it off because it's so easy to get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am buying a quarter of a cow this year, which I'm really excited. Oh, I'm splitting cool. A quarter of a cow. And I bought 10 chickens from some organic farmers. And I'm quite excited. I just moved to a really small town in Wisconsin with my husband. There are 800 people in this town. And so it's been tough, but it has been really important as well because it's encouraging me to work a little bit harder to get these sustainable. And I think my food is actually becoming more sustainable now because I can't just go to the health food grocery store and buy something there. You know, I really have to dig in and get it locally and make sure that I'm doing the work to eat well.
That's awesome though.
Thank you. I'm excited. I just had to share. That was just kind of a moment that I had
to celebrate. Yeah, I love it.
So what kinds of recipes do you share on your blog? And do you have any rules about what ingredients you allow into those recipes?
We have kind of a loose set of rules. So we talk a lot about accessible from scratch cooking with like an eco-friendly focus. So again, it's like about, I try to focus on integrating these conversations about sustainability into the kind of stuff we're already talking about. So if we happen to be sharing, I keep going back to salmon today, but if we happen to be sharing a salmon recipe, then we'll talk about why Alaskan salmon is so special. But we try not to shove it down people's throats too much. Again, to just kind of help with the overwhelm. We want baby steps and we want people to feel like they can do it and like they can accomplish something and that it's not like a big scary thing. My readers really love cheese and really love pasta. So we share a lot of things with cheese and pasta, which I am all for. And we try to just focus on seasonal, you know, vegetables. We don't share a ton of meat recipes. I used to be a vegetarian for environmental reasons, and then I really missed salmon again. So we still rarely eat meat, but when we do, it's nice not to feel like super guilty about it, I guess. We choose, you know, grass-fed or local or, you know, the best kind of stuff we can find. So we talk about that when we do share meat recipes. It's definitely not an all vegetarian blog. And then as far as ingredients, we don't use anything processed, in our recipes. So like, we're never going to make like an Oreo crust cheesecake or, like a graham cracker thing. We don't use marshmallows or, we don't do a lot of sweet stuff, mostly because I just don't have a sweet tooth, but that's changing a little more as we bring on more staff because they're like, we'll eat the cake if you make it, so I can test a little more. Yeah, but so kind of just staying away from processed stuff, like ranch seasoning packets are one that I know a lot of people really love, and it might taste great. And I definitely, that doesn't mean I don't eat those things on occasion. Like I crushed half a bag of Oreos last weekend with some friends and it was great. But that is the kind of stuff that we tend to stay away from on the website just to keep it a little bit more on brand and to be not inspirational, but to show you that like you can cook with real food and it doesn't have to take 2 hours. We try to focus on stuff that's ready like in under an hour, under 30 minutes, that doesn't use too many ingredients. And that tastes really good. So
I love that. And yeah, I value so highly like the balance kind of that it sounds like you're trying to strike. Like, yeah, you don't have to be totally vegan and you don't have to eat nothing processed, but there's so many reasons to not eat processed food from so many different standpoints. You know, your personal health, you know, that could be a whole nother day. And so that's something I'm really working on as well. But yeah, avoiding that overwhelm by just kind of presenting different options that are manageable.
Yeah. And I think people, there are always people like, especially with the internet, who are going to be like, oh, like, and I mean, people say this to me too. It's like, you're a bad environmentalist. You must not care about sustainable food because, you know, you sometimes eat chicken. And I just want people to know, like, you can eat a cheeseburger and not be a terrible person. Like, it doesn't, it's again, it's not all or nothing. You have to do what works for you and your life. And the reality is, like, we are all products of a food system that has taught us to like certain things, like Oreos or like cheeseburgers. And we can't just throw our tastes out overnight, even if it is, you know, would have an environmental impact. So start where you are and don't let anybody make you feel bad if you can't be, like, all in on day one. We'll get there. And yes, the small steps do help. So
yes, completely. I love everything you just said. So these next couple questions are kind of selfishly for me on things that I'm working on. But how do you eat locally in the winter if you're in a climate like I am that has snow and no produce in the winter?
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate to live in a town that has winter CSAs and a winter farmers market, which definitely is new. I've never had that before. So we take advantage of those things occasionally, but I tend to preserve a lot. Not necessarily all canning, although I can like a ton of tomatoes every year and we eat tomato sauce with like everything. But I freeze a lot of things. We are members of an awesome summer CSA and our farmers are amazing. CSA is community supported agriculture. For those who don't know, so you buy, like you basically buy into a farm for the summer or for the season. So you pay up front and then every week or every so often you get to go pick up a box of produce from your farmer. So that's a really great way to find great local produce. But we preserve like a lot of really just like a lot of tomatoes. I'm thinking about what we ate last winter and it was tomato soup like all the time because I love it. yeah, preserving a lot of tomatoes. I freeze a lot of fruit in the summer when we can get it. So, and then being smart about just kind of like our meal planning too. So I try to meal plan and I succeed maybe like 70% of the time. But like looking at, you know, so like this weekend I'm going to pick our tomatoes for the winter and thinking like, okay, what are we going to eat in the winter? It's going to be chili because we can have dried beans with our tomato sauce from the summer. We're going to do a lot of soups. Winter is when I tend to do the most baking. So we eat a lot more bread, a lot more cookies, if I'm being totally honest, but things like that. And then in the summer, it's like, you know, those same tomatoes, I'll just slice it up and eat it for lunch. So repurposing a lot of seasonal stuff to last through the winter, or to be available to us in the winter is like definitely my number one go-to.
Yes, that is all such good information. I love that. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So what is a recipe or a food that you are loving right now?
Ooh. So our CSA is starting to roll in like all the heirloom tomatoes right now. So I have just been eating like sliced heirloom tomatoes with salt on them. And that has been like my happy place all week.
Oh my gosh,
just
yum.
So amazing. So right now I'm definitely all about tomatoes. That's one of my favorite foods, even though my block is life as a strawberry, but strawberry season is over now. So yeah, so I'm all about the tomatoes right now. I'll like make toast and put some burrata and some tomato on it with some basil. That's all I need.
Yum. That all sounds so good. What are you working on right now that you are the most excited about?
So I think I can tell you. So we're in the process. So we're about to launch what we're calling Plastic Free October, except it'll probably have a better name by the time we actually launch it. That's just what we're calling it internally. So we're working on a 30-day challenge for people who want to eliminate some plastic or some single-use items from their home kitchen. And so we're doing a lot of, like, again, really accessible, like, quick wins, tips that to help you just kind of, like, one, take stock of your kitchen life. So I think the hardest part is going through and like kind of doing an audit of where you're wasting food or plastic or where you can cut back. So taking people through those steps in a really friendly way. Again, like, you're not a bad person if you use Saran Wrap. We're just going to help you figure out an alternative. So one of the components of that month is that we are currently testing like 10 different reusable straws, my team and I. So we're really excited. We're really excited about all these straws that we just ordered, first of all. But so we're testing, like, because we're total, like, again, it's, we're research geeks. And so I'm like, yes, I get to analyze something and I get to compile data. So I'm pretty excited about that. And we're testing like all these different kinds of reusable straw materials with all of these different drinks. And so I'm really excited to see the data from our testers come in for that. And I'm really excited for October. I think it's going to be a fun challenge.
That is so exciting. I can't wait for that to happen. I'm so excited to participate. I'm also, along with all these other things, trying to reduce the plastic in my life. I feel like I'm just at the start of all of these like wellness, sustainability things. Yeah. And I just like want to do it all at once and I can't, and I'm starting and I feel good, but then I feel bad because I'm not doing so much. And it's just like an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah.
So having tools,
I totally
like,
get it.
Yeah. So having tools like, you know, this 30-day challenge are just so valuable for me. And I can't wait to dig in and share it with people when it comes out.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm excited.
So if everybody else is as excited as I am about all the different things that you have going on, where can they find you on social media?
So social media, I'm at Life as a Strawberry on Instagram. And then the podcast is At the Table Podcast on Instagram. And then we're on all the, you know, Twitter, Facebook. We're most active on Instagram, so that's probably the best place to find us and connect.
Awesome. I am so excited. I so enjoyed our conversation. I feel like I could ask you a million more questions and we could talk forever, but we have
to
go.
Yeah, I know.
So thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, this was so fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Isn't Jessie so smart and so good at breaking down the complicated issues? I love that she shared ways to cut through the noise of all of the things that we should be doing to be more sustainable. And how much did you love it when she got so real about all of the haters out there, telling her that even she isn't doing enough to be a good environmentalist? Because hello, all we can do is try the best we can to create sustainable habits that we can actually do. All of the amazing resources that Jessie provides to help us do our best to eat sustainably are in the show notes for this episode at www.simplylivedinpodcast.com. If you feel like you're a little bit more able to tackle your goal of eating more sustainably after this episode, please hop on over to iTunes and leave us a review. They are so important to growing this show. Until next time, Simply listeners, remember, start where you are, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Simply Lived In podcast. Dive into show notes for this episode and all past episodes at simplylivedinpodcast.com. If you love the show, please share with your friends. Help us to spread the power of simplicity. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep up your quest for less.